for his household. We were going to get into that in a minute. I'm jumping ahead. I'm pretty talkative tonight. So we have talked about a few of these covenants on the podcast. Every few generations, God likes to reset the board game a bit and add or take away or alter some of the rules and pray I don't alter them further. Adam and Eve had a set of rules. New rules were set with Noah after the flood, and here in Genesis 17, God and Abraham sit down, and God makes Abraham an offer he can't refuse. Here we go. This is Genesis. I said 17, but I'm starting at 15 because I like to add context to everything. So Genesis 15, God also said to Abraham, "As for Sarah, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarah. Her name will be Sarah." So God gets off on renaming stuff. He renames shit all the time. And you're like, why? Numerology, maybe, bros. Hold on. "I will bless her, and she will surely give you a son by her, and I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of people will come from her." And Abraham fell face down and laughed and said unto himself, "Will a son be born to a man 100 years old, and will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abraham said to God, "If only Ishmael might live under your blessing." And God said, "Yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for your descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you, and I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his number, but will be the father of the 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation, but my covenant will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year." And he had finished speaking with Abraham, God went up from him. And on that very day, Abraham took his son Ishmael and all those born in his household or bought with his money, every male in his household, and circumcised them. He is cutting like 500 dicks, dudes. And God told him, Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised, and his son Ishmael was 13. And Abraham and his son Ishmael were both circumcised on that very day. And every male in Abraham's household, including those born in his household or bought from a foreigner, were circumcised. That's a lot of foreskins, man. We see Abraham as the father and taking on the priestly role for his household. And again, here, I'm sure we will do an episode on this story as we go through this, but it's another instance of the younger son getting a better blessing than the older son. But as one sort of echoed through history still to this day, if you know what I'm saying. Anyhow, back to all these dicks. Circumcision in its obsession is pure, in its inception is purely phallic rite, having for its aim the marking of that from which the association is viewed with a peculiar veneration. This guy loves the word peculiar, by the way. Reading this whole book in a few days, like, I'm fucking tired of trying its connections to the two phases of the superstition, which have been at their object respectively, the of generation and the agent. We are thus brought back to the consideration of the simplest form of phallic worship. Well, that which has referenced the generative organs viewed as the mysterious instruments with the realization of the keen desire of children, which are distinguished all primitive peoples. So we're moving into the next chapter. Serpent symbolism associated with phallic worship. The next chapter, serpent symbolism associated with phallic worship. That we have in the Mosaic account of the fall, a phallic legend is evident from other considerations connected with the narrative. The most important relate to the introduction of the serpent on the scene and the position it takes as the inciting cause of the sinful act. Who tells us the serpent was a special symbol of the worship of Bacchus? We're actually back in the book now, if you can't. Now, this annual holds a very curious place in the religions of civilized people of antiquity, although the consequence of the influence of later thought, it came to be treated as the personification of evil. And as such appears in the Hebrew legend of the fall. Yet, before this, the serpent was a symbol of wisdom and healing. We've seen this in a lot of our other episodes, especially dealing with the Gnosticism. And later capacity, it appears to have a connection with the Exodus of Egypt. And we're going to get into that in a minute. It is, however, in its character as a symbol of wisdom that is more especially claims our attention. Although these ideas are intimately connected, the power of healing being merely a phase of wisdom, the earliest times of which we have historical notice, the serpent has been connected to the gods of wisdom. This animal was especially the symbol of Thoth or Tawut, the primeval deity of Syro-Egyptian mythology, and all of those gods such as Hermes and Seth who can be connected with him. The serpent was also the symbol of the Egyptian Kenef, who resembled the Sophia of the Gnostics, the divine wisdom. This animal, moreover, was a, oh boy, Aga, I had problems with this before when I was reading it, was the Agathodemon of the religions of antiquity, the giver of happiness and good fortune. It was the capacities rather than having a phallic significance that the serpent was associated with the sun gods, the Chaldean Bel, the Grecian Apollo, and the Semitic Seth. There came to be not only good but also bad serpents, both of which are referred to in the narrative of the Hebrew Exodus. And you're like, what are you talking about? I don't understand serpents and Exodus. But still more clearly, the struggle between the good and the bad serpents of Persian mythology, the symbolized Ormuzd or Mithra, the evil spirit Ahriman. In Exodus 7, Moses and the Pharaoh have a dick measuring contest. Like, literally, if you were to do a realistic reading of this passage, you'd be like, oh, they were measuring dicks. And I think Moses probably had the bigger, big, veiny cock